Small Biz America.
The Brain.
Hi, I'm David Wolf. Joining us on this segment is someone recognized as one of the leading experts in the franchise community. Dick Renick has built large-scale multi-unit operations, such as American Leak Detection and others. He's also served as chairman of the International Franchise Association Educational Foundation, and in 2005 became chairman of the IFA. Today, with the creation of his company, Team Renick, Dick is helping to provide insights, experience, and possibly some shortcuts to emerging franchise company entrepreneurs. Joining us on the line to share the work he does with franchise companies is Dick Renick. Dick, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Dick, first, if you would, take us back to the early days of franchising before the industry information had consolidated like it is now and was not available like it is today. And when there weren't franchise coaches and consultants, what did franchising look like when you first got into the business?
Well, it was certainly much different than it is today. When I got into franchising in the very early 80s, 81, 82, there was only about just a little under 400 members that belonged to the International Franchise Association.
Wow.
And there was only 23 franchise industries. Today, 30 years later, there are right at 3,000 franchise companies. And within the International Franchise Association, including the franchise team members, there are about 30,000 members of the IFA. And so it has grown considerably. It has broadened its scope and has had a huge impact on the franchise sector across the board. And maybe as this interview goes on, we can talk about the economic impact study that we did in 2001 and 2005 by PricewaterhouseCoopers, and then the latest so that it shows the impact that franchising has on the U.S. economy.
There was a different regulatory environment as well in those early days, wasn't there?
I was heavily involved in the regulatory issues of the late 60s, early 70s of what they call the Suede Shoe Act, where people would come to town like a traveling salesman and charge somebody $5,000 for a franchise, and then they would leave town with several $5,000 tickets in their pocket, and you'd never see or hear from them again. So states and Federal Trade Commission got involved and put together the what they called the FTC rule on franchising and formed a document called the UFOC, which stood for Uniform Franchise Disclosure Document, and offering circular. And so what occurred is that that went along very well for about 35 years, and over the last 11 years, several notable franchise attorneys and several state regulators came through with a new document now called the Uniform Franchise Disclosure Document instead of the UFOC. And it has made some significant changes. The rule came about so that people were not being taken advantage of without a rule that was either federally specific or some states. There are 15 states in the United States that have their own registration. So it has come a long ways, and it is a much better group today in the franchise community. We have very few issues and incidents that we had in years past. So it is the road has been paved over the last 10, 15 years with many notables from the franchise sector that I can certainly name when you're ready, that have all had a dealing in getting a level playing field for franchising nationwide.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about perhaps the business piece of all of this. Your coaches, mentors, and your guides to these upcoming business entrepreneurs and anybody who's accomplished the kinds of things you have in their business career have had a mentor. Who were your mentors? Who did you look to at any stage of your career that you'd like to highlight for us?
Well, frankly, I enjoyed spending time with the likes of the guy that founded the International Franchise Association, Bill Rosenberg. He was the founder of a little company called Dunkin' Donuts.
Yes, I know about Bill. That's right.
I spent a lot of time with Bill and his bride, both in Cape Cod and in their place down in Florida. I was very lucky to spend time with Dave Thomas and with Ray Kroc and his wife. And I've learned and ridden on the shoulders of some true giants. In the recent past, I would say that one of my mentors is a guy by the name of Sid Feltenstein, who came out of Dunkin' Donuts, and about 14, 15 years ago bought a well-known brand that was going south called A&W Root Beer. And then he also bought Long John Silver's and did a great job with both of those, sold them, and just recently he sold them to Yum Brands, and then he stayed on for a couple of years, and now he just finished purchasing a company called Del Taco, which is a about a 900-unit chain on the West Coast. And he's been a true mentor and a guide to me. There's one other fellow that was with a company called Mailboxes, etc. Mm-hmm. His name was Jim Amos. And he has been a guide and a mentor and a coach to me along the way as well. And these notables are within the last 10, 12 years. And then just from the franchisor side, on the franchisee side, one of the things that I really enjoyed was spending time with a guy that owns about 40 Great American Chocolate Chip Company stores down in Houston, Texas. His name is Doc Cohen, and he was one of the first franchisees that was allowed into the International Franchise Association. And so it helped me because I was able to learn from these notables on the franchisor side. And then besides my own franchise team members within my company, I was able to learn from other franchisees on the franchisee side. So I've been very fortunate.
When you think about, you know, Ray Kroc, which certainly that was a different time, the mid to late 50s, when franchising was new, or you think about a Dave Thomas a little further down the path, or Feltenstein or Amos or any of them, if I had to ask you, what is it that the successful franchisors, these business builders, got about what they were doing that many perhaps don't get and you help them with now?
Well, they were never afraid to take a chance. They were gamblers. A true entrepreneur is nothing more than a gambler that gambles on business and gambles on being a success in their business and making other people that buy into their enterprise, they like to come on board because they're getting on board with a true entrepreneurial spirit.
Yeah.
And I will tell you that growing up in San Bernardino, California, where the McDonald brothers, Richard and Ralph McDonald, started the operation, and where Ray Kroc was a Hamilton Beach malt and milk salesman, that in 1958 and 59 finally put a deal together to buy the McDonald brothers out. He was the same way. He decided to just take it. He liked what it was that excited him about McDonald's that a lot of people don't know, is that they had a way of keeping their hamburgers warm so that they could pre-make their burgers, and people would come up and for 35 cents they could get a hamburger, a Coke, and a order of French fries for 35 cents and go down the road. And Ray Kroc saw that, and he decided to take on that initiative. And a lot of people don't know Dave Thomas, and they don't know that he only had a sixth-grade education and that he was adopted, but he also was an entrepreneur and was a gambler. He wasn't afraid to take a chance. He actually figured out, just like all entrepreneurs, like the Amoses and the Feltensteins and the Crocs and the Bill Rosenbergs and all the other entrepreneurs in the franchise sector and non-franchise sector,
yes,
is they're not afraid to take a chance. And I have this simple philosophy, is that I say that when entrepreneurs get into business, they usually have a bow and arrow and they have a target 100 yards down the way, and they pull back the bow and they shoot the arrow. And when the arrow's flying to hit the target, they have to run down there, pick up the target, and move the target around so that that arrow
can
hit that target.
I love that
visual.
Because,
you see, they don't know exactly what's going to happen. They don't know, even though they can make all the plans and have all the money and have everything that it takes to make them a success, they don't know which way they got to move the target. They don't know if it's got to go up, got to go down. But the key is they want that arrow to hit the target.
So they're very, very brave, and they're risk takers. Do they also get something about what people want? I mean, do they understand human nature in a way? Did Kroc understand that everybody wanted a hamburger, fries, and a Coke that simple for a certain price? It may be different for each of these guys, but what fascinates you about these franchisors from that standpoint?
Well, that they weren't afraid to take a chance, and that they knew that they were onto something. Ray Kroc knew that by preheating hamburgers, they was onto something, and he could see by the long lines from the local high school, San Bernardino High School, that came across the street to eat at the original McDonald's that is now a museum. They were able to see that, and they were able to get behind the fact that if it's good for kids, let's make it for the kids. And he never did go after the adult. If you'll see all of a lot of his advertising back in the 70s and 80s and early 90s, never dealt with advertising for the adult. They were advertising to the kids that were watching the ads on TV.
Mm-hmm.
And they got to go get a hamburger cup, and they got to go get a Big Mac, and they got to go get all these different games that were tainted towards the kids. And only in the last several years has current management at Wendy's McDonald's and other fast food chains, only in the last few years have they seen that, gee whiz, grown people like to come in with their kids and get something to eat, and so they maybe make a salad or make a chicken sandwich or make something that isn't just kid-specific. And I think that that all grows over time. Rosenberg never sold anything besides a hot cup of coffee and donuts. Today, walk into a Dunkin' Donuts and tell me what you see in there for sale.
Yes.
It changes, and I think that what drives that change is that the entrepreneurs and the management of these companies have to be able to measure and monitor the demand of the people walking through the door. And based on that demand, they've got to be smart enough to pick it up and understand it. And that's one of the things that we at Team Rennick have learned over the years working with these people, is to be able to help those entrepreneurs that are getting into the franchise sector. We want to help them to measure and monitor and be able to provide service, whether it is a fast food takeout, whether it is a tasty treat kind of a thing, or if it's somebody that's doing window washing, or they're doing carpet cleaning, or they're doing mobile car repair, or whatever it may be. We have to measure the market and figure out what the demand is so that their systems grow. And the growth of their systems is important that the franchise team members, I don't call them franchisees. I don't like the term a franchisee. I like the term member of a team. If you become a member of the system and a member of the team, you work together to measure and monitor as a cohesive team, so that you can become a winner like some of the great football teams that you've seen, and hockey teams and basketball teams. And if they can understand that, that's when they become a success.
We're visiting with Dick Rennick of Team Rennick and the website www.teamrennick.com. When you first meet at Team Rennick, when you first meet with a startup franchisor, or perhaps they're a little bit further down the path, what do you find that they need help with most, and what does the process look like as you walk them into what's ahead of them?
Very good question. First thing that we do is we like to do an assessment. It's pretty hard to understand what their issues are unless we go in and spend 2 or 3 days with the current ownership and top management and find out what it is that they're doing. And they may have one franchise, no franchise, or they may have 100 franchises or 200 or 1,000. We don't know. We have to be able to do an assessment, and we have to be able to find out what it is they're looking for. You see, we don't know what they're looking for, and sometimes they don't know what they're looking for. But by going in and asking proper questions and being able to find out what it is that they want to accomplish, do they want to get their system going to the left? Do they want to get it going to the right? Do they want it to go up? Do they want it to go down? Do they want to spread market base? Do they want to spread services? We have to know what all that is so that we can embellish that brand, and we can only do that by an on-site visit.
When you visit with an entrepreneur like this, they come in and they're likely to be pretty in love with their own idea. Some are more objective, but clearly there's an emotional attachment to what they're creating. It's just the case with entrepreneurs and those that take these kinds of risks. Can you recognize what's a good idea and what isn't, and can you help with that recognition sense for a young startup?
Yeah, boy, I tell you, that is a very good question and a very good statement. The issue with most entrepreneurs is that they're pretty strong-headed. I know that I was strong-headed, and I had some great ideas about my company, and you couldn't convince me that I needed to go left, and you couldn't convince me I needed to go right. And finally, one day, I was confronted by the staff and said, look, we're being stalled here, we're being stalled there, our marketing is this, and our marketing is that. We don't know what to call the company. We've got four names. We need to pick one. And so I went out and hired a company that specializes in brand building. And they came in, and everything that I thought was great, he beat me up. I mean, after 11 months, I paid this guy a couple hundred thousand dollars to tell me what the hell I was doing wrong. And that was a real eye-opener for me, and it was the best thing that ever happened to me, is that even though I thought I was smart and we were doing great, we were stalled for three or four years. And this completely changed things, and so I've taken that, and I've been able to go and share with other entrepreneurs from my own experience of getting beat up and what they need to look at. And some, no matter what you do, they'll never buy into the fact that they might not know it all. They'll never buy into the fact that they may already know it all and they don't need help. And that's when you have to let them take the lead. I don't want to stay and make them do things that they don't want to do. One of the things that we at Team Rennick have worked diligently to do over the last several years is we don't give them a, you must do this or you must do that. And my explanation for that is quite simple. We kind of set the table so that they come and feast. We may give them three different kinds of mashed potatoes and three different kinds of meats and three different kinds of something to drink and three different kinds of some vegetables, et cetera, if you get my meaning.
Yeah.
Because we don't know their business like they do. But if we can give them some ideas that they can pick from that will help them to grow their business, and we can kind of coach them and monitor and mentor them to move that direction, we've had some very great success in that venue, and we're not going to change what's working. So we set the table, and they figure out what they've got to do to help them grow their business.
Dick, what's the length of the relationship look like when you work with a client like that?
It runs anywhere from 1 to 3 years. I've got one that, I've got two that Team Rennick actually provides interim CEOs and interim top managers for them.
Wow.
We like doing the interim work because it puts somebody on the ground, and we may not be there every day, but we're in constant contact every day.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes we have to train. There's one that I'm interim CEO for right now called Assisting Hands Home Care out of Boise, Idaho. I went on with a 6-month stint, and I'm just finishing my second year as interim CEO, and I've been training my replacement. And he wants to move from COO to president, but doesn't want to let go of the interim CEO to me yet.
Wow.
Even though I think he's well qualified to do it, we just never know. The relationship to us, you can't build a business without a relationship. So we build a relationship, and then we work together to build a business. And that's why we stay with people for such a long time.
Is there any commonality to the items that tend to trip up these early stage franchisor companies? Anything common in what you've seen over the years?
Yes, sir. Underfunded in 95% of the cases. It's those people that have taken a couple of hundred thousand dollars to take their business to the next level, to pay to get it franchised, to get audited financials, to get operations manuals and all the things and all the bells and whistles it takes to get your franchise system up. That may be the only $200,000 they have. And if they don't get franchise sales, they don't have any money to replenish that. And so many of the times, especially with young upcomers, we've got one in Canada that we're bringing into the U.S. We've got one that we brought in from Australia. And we've got others that are in this country that we're working with as we speak today that have one or two operations going. And they've got a fantastic concept, but are heavily underfunded. The second nemesis is having the proper people in the proper positions. No matter whether you're selling foods or treats or some kind of a service, sometimes they have people in positions that really haven't been matched to the position. And many times it comes in the form of a family member It comes in the form of a best friend or a good friend, and that best friend or good friend should have continued his work as a mortician at the local mortuary instead of coming in and taking over franchise sales.
Sure.
And nothing against morticians and nothing against any of that kind of venue, but sometimes you can't mix and match. Sometimes you have to forget about the family involvement. Sometimes you have to forget about the friendship involvement, and you've got to do what's best for the company. And it's tough. It's tough. That's a big nemesis, is the who to hire, why to hire, and gee whiz, my second cousin is a great guy, and he's been washing cars all of his life and changing tires. We think now we need to make him vice president of marketing, and that may not work.
Clearly at Team Renick, you're experiencing all these facets of all the dynamics that go into the people part, the operations part, the execution, the sales of franchise units, keeping them up and running, and the financing, which as we sit together in early March of 2010 is still a little ominous, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Luckily, I'm still involved in some of that and working as a past chairman of the International Franchise Association.
Yeah.
We're still called upon to get involved in some of the networking of what's happening in the lending sector. I know that Matt Shea, the CEO of the International Franchise Association, a longtime good friend of mine, is on Capitol Hill often, going after money, both in congressional hearings, and it's taken us a dozen years to build that relationship. And now that we've got that relationship built, Capitol Hill is finally listening to us. They're listening to the likes of a Doc Cohen that's been called in to talk. They've listened to the likes of Dina Dwyer Owens, the CEO of the Dwyer Group out of Waco, Texas. They listened to Doc, and they listened to Matt Shea, and they listened to others. And now, for the first time in 12 years, the franchise community is being recognized on Capitol Hill as a powerful tool because we employ 21 million people in the franchise sector. 21 million with a total economic output of payroll of $854 billion, B with a billion, $1 billion. And when you see that, Capitol Hill has taken a long time to understand and watch us, and now we usually get the call to come in and help when we're talking about small business. Because after all, if you look back, what was it that built this country? It was small business. What was it that's been around since prior to the 19th century? Franchising. It's been around for a couple of hundred years. Only in the last 50 years has it really raised its head as a business format franchise, which was coined after Ray Kroc. But it's been around a long time, and we're just happy to be the people that are looked to on Capitol Hill to give an economic indicator of what's going on in small business. Doesn't have to be franchised, because a lot of the people that work with us are in non-franchise businesses. We
sure.
have as many people that service franchising that are non-franchised that are in the franchise sector. And those people need to be recognized as well. And we're well tuned into that. And so with that, Capitol Hill is recognizing us and is bringing in people from the UPSs of the world and the Postnets and other venues to get them on Capitol Hill to share what's going on in small business.
Well, thank goodness for the work you're doing, and congratulations for that. I think we'll leave it there for this segment. We've been visiting with Dick Renick, co-founder of a consultancy they call Team Renick. For more information, the website www.teamrennick.com. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Small Biz America.
The brain.
Online at smallbizamerica.com.
Small Biz.
Small Biz America.